Christian Gospel with Dr. Halissa Elwine. Join us around our Shabbat dining table as we explore the Torah portion.
Okay, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. 1 Corinthians 5:6. Paul is trying to teach the Corinthians how to observe Passover, which is encouraging that they're keeping the Passover, but they've got some significant problems, like they missed the whole point of Passover, which is what we've been going over. And here's what he said to them: your boasting is not good. In other words, they've got pride issues. They've got a proud look, which came from a heart devising wicked plan. He says, do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough? Clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. What are we supposed to be leavened with? Why don't we get rid of the chametz? Why don't we get rid of that earthly leaven once a year? What kind of leaven are you supposed to allow to work once you get that old leaven out? It's the leaven of the kingdom. It's the leaven of the kingdom that's going to be offered at Shavuot, 7 times 7 later. That's why you clean it out. You're preparing for the leaven of the kingdom. And this has to be the leaven of truth and sincerity. He says, for Messiah, our Passover also has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness. Why are we speaking malicious words? But with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. See, when you have malicious thoughts about somebody, it's going to affect the words that come out of your mouth. And you might tell the truth, just like those false witnesses, but the way that you tell the truth will not be true. He says, I wrote you in my letter not to associate with immoral people. I did not at all mean with the immoral people of this world, or with the covetous and swindlers, or with idolaters, for then you'd have to go out of the world. But actually, I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he is an immoral person, or covetous, or an idolater, or a reviler, remember the reviler, or a drunkard, or a swindler, not even to eat with such a one. Don't even eat with them. What have I to do with judging outsiders? Do you not judge those who are within the assembly? But those who are outside, God judges. Remove the wicked man from among yourselves. You say, now, wait a minute. Aren't you just telling me that the most wicked thing we can do is to separate brothers? Mm-hmm. But what did Paul say? Any so-called brother. How do you know he's not your brother? He's immoral, covetous, an idolater, a reviler. A reviler, somebody who uses malicious words toward people, especially within the body of Messiah, a drunkard, or a swindler. It says, don't even eat with him. Don't just put him out from the congregation. Don't meet him, you know, for a burger at Wendy's. Cut him off so they'll repent. Well, who first associated with an immoral person? Adam and Eve. They associated with a slanderer. And so after you read that letter to the Corinthians, we think, why are we so hesitant to confront a slanderer? We're not even supposed to eat with such a person. And the problem is, even though it's a very sour fruit, it looks juicy. It sounds juicy. Let's go back to this reviler. What is a reviler? Well, it's Strong's 3060 in the Greek. And that's a railer or a reviler. I mean, I don't think we even use the word railer anymore. Oh, he was just railing on me. Okay. I don't know that I've heard that word recently. We know what it means to revile someone. But let's look at its Hebrew cognate. And its Hebrew cognate is a word, madon. Madon. And it's coming from the word din, which is judgment. We're making a judgment about a person. Well, that's exactly what Paul wrote to the Corinthians. He says, what do I have to do with judging outsiders? Do you not judge those who are within the assembly? Those who are outside, God judges. You remove the wicked man from among yourselves. You have to judge internally. And this is why leaders are set up in congregations to find out, you know, do we have a reviler in our midst? Do we have somebody who consistently initiates quarrels? Somebody who's continuously brawling with words, spreading discord, spreading strife, always in contention. He says, you have to judge that within yourself. Don't worry about the world. Adonai will take care of them. But those who are walking with you, because what are you doing? You may not attach too much weight to things that the world tells you. You definitely don't believe anything you see on the news, right? I hope you don't. But you got a 50-50 chance of it actually being the truth. Probably less of a chance that it hasn't been twisted, that it's that false witness where there's an element of truth in it, but they're telling it, packaging it, and placing it in such a way that it has become an untruth. I think they call that spin. But you do have to judge those within your own congregation. And this madon that comes from judgment, it means a contest, a quarrel, brawling, contention, discord, strife. If there's somebody who always seems to be in the middle of a quarrel, if it's somebody that's like their whole life is characterized by strife, I mean, to them, strife is life and life is strife. You have to start asking some questions. What kind of quarrel are they stirring up? It could be that they're like Paul. They just keep teaching the gospel to idolaters and they get beat up a lot. Or since we're talking about brothers, I mean, yeah, Paul's going to people out in the world. He's going to get beat up if he tells the truth. But if it's somebody who time after time within a congregation of believers is creating contention and strife or always seems to be at the middle of it, once the dust clears, we have to start judging those within. Because the problem there, scripture is telling us, is there's pride. It's leaven, because it's arrogance that leads us to start quarrels. That once we initiate these quarrels, that's when we become really prone to start distorting the truth. We will start with some true information and then we'll begin distorting it. That's the leaven. And that's what the serpent in the garden was doing. He was trafficking falsely twisted information. Part of that information was true. The way he packaged and placed it, the way he spun it, caused deception. And then it became violence. And then what happens? It made them die. Killing people is violent. That's exactly what, and he didn't lay hands on them. He didn't lay one scale. I don't know what snakes. I guess he had at least feet back then. The implication is that he walked around. So he lost his legs, but it doesn't sound like he even touched either one of them. He just used words to commit violence. So I say, when people say they want to kill you, you probably better believe them. And that's what slander is. It's a reviling truth. And it separates human beings from Elohim and one another. It's probably not the whole story. It's just enough of the story to deceive you. And you have to get rid of this stuff before Passover. It's chametz. It's leaven. And so my advice in the newsletter was, you know what? As you're searching for the leaven and the days are counting down toward Passover and you get closer to those 7 days of matzah, you have to be on hyper alert against slander, gossip, lies, malicious talk, not just with one another, but, you know, if you're using TV, if you're using, you know, the internet, social media, whatever it is, however words get into you, if during that time you have to tape your mouth shut and wear noise-canceling headphones, do it. It's not worth dragging it into Passover. So here's some words for madon, this word that we're talking about being quarrelsome. Paul calls it a reviler. And remember, the Hebrew cognate is going to be Strong's 4066. Here's a few examples. Proverbs 6:14, who with perversity in his heart continually devises evil. who spreads strife. What's the fourth abomination of the wicked lamp? A heart devising wicked plans. The heart devising wicked plans eventually makes it to the seventh abomination, and he spreads the strife that completely separates brothers. Or at least the word actually means just to spread apart, a rift. He creates a rift between people. Proverbs 16:28, a perverse man spreads strife, and a slanderer separates intimate friends. Somebody who has a habit of separating close friends is a perverse person, not just violent, perverse, a pervert. They're a word pervert. When we spread strife that causes a rift between people who are friends, we're a word pervert. And you should be on a list somewhere. I mean, we do it to regular perverts. Why don't we do it to word perverts? Probably because we're all perverted. We've all done this. It's the most difficult things. In fact, what we're going to read out of James, he says, no man can tame it. Apparently, it's going to be something that we are going to have to fight the good fight all the way up until the resurrection of the dead, or at least until we cross over. Proverbs 26:21, like charcoal to hot embers and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. What are they doing? They're judging. They've made a judgment in the relationship. Madon. And according to their judgment, this person is less than me. And to make sure I can have the place that this person had, maybe you're trying to insinuate yourself into that relationship. Maybe you have bigger plans. Maybe you need that person's esteem taken away in that relationship in order to further different plans. It doesn't matter. You have made a judgment that that person and the place of esteem that that person has with other people is worth less than who you think you are. And it says it's like charcoal to hot embers and wood to a fire. No matter where they go, the word perverts are going to kindle strife, which means they're going to kindle judgment, but not always properly. They're going to be twisting things. They're only going to be telling you as much of the truth as they want you to have to turn you against the person or to make you think less of them. Proverbs 28:25 says an arrogant man stirs up strife. Arrogant. See the pride? Well, what's the opposite of a prideful person? But he who trusts in the Lord will prosper. See what's going on there? If you trust in Adonai, you're going to prosper. You trust him enough to place you in the positions or the circumstances according to his will. But if you have pride, you don't even trust him enough to do that. And you feel like you have to kindle strife in order to raise yourself in someone else's eyes. And to put, you know, like wicked Haman, may his name be blotted out. To secure your position by tearing someone else down out of theirs. All that means when we slander, when we gossip, when we say malicious things about people, bottom line, we don't trust Adonai. We're not willing to give him the situation because we feel like we can do a better job than he can. It's tongue leaven. So here's what James said. We've all heard this before, but and it's a tough one and it always will be. James 3:5, it says, so also the tongue, it's a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. See how pride works? It can take the tiniest thing and make it huge. The tiniest bit of truth and make it a great lie. See how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire? And the tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body, word perverts, and sets on fire the course of our life. And it is set on fire by hell. For every species of beasts and birds, of reptiles and creatures of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by the human race. But no one can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil and full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come both blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be this way. does a fountain send out from the same opening both fresh water and bitter? Wow, that's tough. And it needs to be, because who wants to go to the gates of the garden and be identified as a word pervert? So from James's warning that it's going to be pride that sets the stage for the evil tongue and all the abominations that follow. What is pride? Again, it's wanting to secure our position, to improve our position, to climb up a little bit. It's insecurity. It doesn't mean it's not evil when we try to fix it ourselves by damaging someone else. So Passover is not just about finding leavened products in our home. It's about finding arrogance inside of us. Leviticus 19, 15 through 18, it talks about this relationship. Typically, in a relationship, we're making judgments. In fact, we're constantly doing evaluations in our relationships based on what just happened. Let me see if I can say this without saying what he actually said. I had a lieutenant one time, a training lieutenant in firearms. And you just can't make mistakes with firearms. You can't make one mistake with a firearm, because if you make one mistake with a firearm, it can destroy your life. It can destroy someone else's life. You might even destroy someone's life you like. Maybe it's your partner. In particular, he was telling us about an incident, you know, when he was on a team and the team was going up the staircase and someone fell. Accidentally, the firearm went off and he killed the guy in front of him. They're on the same team, but it was an accident. So you say you can't make one mistake with a firearm. And he said, you know, one, oh darn, is not made up for by 1,000 attaboys. You can do something wrong once. That's what people will remember. They'll forget 1,000 attaboys. 1,000, great job, excellent, you did it, right on. That can happen 1,000 times, and it's not as strong as one mess up. And with him, it was like in the context of firearms. But how many times, think of words. If a word can be an instrument of violence, of Hamas, just one word is an instrument of violence, then it's important for us to remember how weighty our words are. And we have to judge them aright. I have to judge other human beings properly. And so it says in Leviticus 19, 15, you shall do no injustice in judgment. Remember the Madon? You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great. But you are to judge your neighbor fairly. It shouldn't matter who they are. You judge this circumstance. You judge this incident. Don't worry about how great or ungreat they are. Because if you do, it's going to obscure the facts. You're going to base it, whether some of us lean toward the underdog, the oppressed, the downtrodden. That's what makes a great story. We wouldn't have so many movies. That's how movies sell tickets. It's always going to be the downtrodden, the underdog, the, you know, trodden underfoot that's going to rise up in the end. And we can say, yes. So part of human nature is to weight things for them that they don't deserve, because it's not proper judgment. But you might be one of those that defers to the great because they're rich or because they're famous or because they're beautiful. You're going to lean in that direction because they're stronger. But no. You can't do that either. You judge based on this single thing right here. He says, you judge fairly. Judge your neighbor fairly. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. In other words, if you're slandering, if you're using malicious words, you're committing violence against the life of your neighbor. What words are people known by? We can look at their words. If they are slandering, if they are malicious, if they're even just, I mean, sometimes you don't even have to wonder. They're blatantly violent words. They're acting against the life of their neighbor. They are filled with Hamas. Why did the world get destroyed with a flood? It was filled with Hamas, violence. It didn't have to be fists and bows and arrows and spears. The words of people had reached such a level of violence. So many words were being unleashed against one another. He says, you know what? This world right here is irredeemable. All I can do is save a few. Words, yes, are violence. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. You can go to your neighbor and you can say this hurts, or this is wrong, or this is sin. But you know what you can't do? You can't load up the cart and go talk about it. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. How many times have we quoted, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, and we've left out the context? I just read you the context. Loving your neighbor as yourself means not slandering, not packaging and placing deceptive words about your neighbor, telling part of the story, telling the truth the way that you want to tell it, trying to kill them with Hamas to improve your position or to lower their position relative to you. That's the proud look that's going to lead to a lying tongue and hands that shed innocent blood. Because of a heart that devises wicked plans, people will quickly run to evil, become false witnesses, breathing out lies, and create a separation between brothers, between human being and human being, believer and believer. And I think those are probably predictably the passages that we most consistently apply to other people, not ourselves. But it says, you shall not go about as a slanderer among your people. You say, well, tell me what slander is. Well, the Jewish sages explain this. And they say, this means that if we hear a person telling something bad about his fellow, we should not go and tell him, so-and-so is saying this and this about you, unless it is our intention to remove or avoid injury or to stop a quarrel. Would there ever be a situation like that? Yes, there would. If we know that this is blatantly false and it will ruin someone's business, that it will ruin something else in their lives, then you have to tell it. If you're trying to avoid injury or stop a quarrel, yes. It says of the word rachil, which means a talebearer or a slanderer, that they have two faces, basically. The word rachil, rach, which means soft or kind, they'll approach not the victim, but the hearer of the word, the one who's going to receive the perverted word. They'll be kind and soft to this person when they deliver, when they package and place it. What are they doing? They're being harsh to the person who's not there. Rachil. Another meaning, don't be as a rochel, which is a peddler, a merchant, a trader, loading up with words and going to peddle them. Evil gossip and its partner, slander, bring death to the one who says it, the one who receives it, and the one about whom it is told, but most of all to the one who receives it. He is as one who violates a royal command. When you receive perverted words, I mean, it's just like they've got a cart full of manure and they dump it in your lap, the receiver. And that really explains the violence that the serpent did. He peddled these words to Eve. He packaged and placed them before her in such a way that the truth was obscured. And to this day, he's still peddling words back and forth from human beings to the throne. And most regrettably, and most predictably, back and forth from the people of Adonai to his throne. Because we're still slandering one another. We're still gossiping about one another. We're still malicious and making judgments about one another without all the facts. I mean, that's how gossip works. And what's one of the expressions is, that's how rumors get started. Somebody hears part of what is said and then they run and go tell it. But if both parties aren't there, you don't know the whole story. But because we continue receiving the manure cart of perverted words, he keeps having a reason to accuse us. I mean, he's going to say, yep, they took it hook, line, and sinker. They took the manure. Let me run up here to the throne and tell the Father what they've done. Which is, like I say, it's annoying, but it's kind of his job. Because if we're using word poison against one another, if we're striking one another with words, he's always going to have a load to take up to the throne to tell. Because the same tongue that could have made peace has created distance. It's killed the relationship. Adam and Eve were separated from the presence in the garden. That's the seventh abomination. It creates this separation. But that happens with believers. He's saying, like, forget about even trying to judge people out in the world. It's your relationship with one another that matters right now. How do you think he's going to, he says, don't you know you're going to judge angels? Well, if you can't even judge one another righteously, how in the world do you think he's going to place you in that sort of position of responsibility in the millennium? When we hide our faces from one another and refuse to make peace, we're giving the adversary a lot of ammunition. I'm looking forward to the day when we're just not giving him any more words to peddle, because when that happens, he's going to be cast down to earth. What's it going to take to get our attention? What's it going to take for us to say, I don't want the adversary up there telling the Father every stupid thing I say today? Well, just quit saying stupid things. Easier said than done. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I'm just like, doggone it. I don't even want the thought. And it just keeps coming. But you know what James says? No man can tame it. It doesn't mean you quit trying. And that's your goal. That's going to be on your to-do list. And preparing for Passover, find some place in your life where you can make peace. Peace is not going to make itself. It's not supposed to. Peace has to be made. You know, in the daily prayers, we say, may he who makes peace in his high places make peace upon us and upon all Israel. Peace doesn't just happen. It's not a spontaneous miracle. It starts with the humility between two people who have decided to make, to build peace. Adonai, it's his job to make peace in the heavenly places. He put us here to make peace on earth. If we want to be like the Father, we have to make it. It's not just going to happen. So what's the punishment for a slanderer? It's strange. As we were going through Sefer HaChinuch a couple of weeks ago, which is a breakdown of the 613 commandments, they pointed out that even though it's a violation of the Torah to slander, it doesn't require whiplashes from the court. They say, instead, when we slander people, it's not really humans who judge us, that it's actually Adonai. That if we will not repent of slander, he sends angels, agents of judgment with whiplashes. You say, well, how does Adonai whiplash me? If we look at the definition, it says that shot, which is going to be a whip or a scourge. And you think about Yeshua being whipped, being scourged. It was a literal whip, but what it represented was the tongue, the false words, the slander, the twisted testimonies, the half-truths, the whole lies, the whip, it's the tongue. And it says, especially of the scourge of God, of calamities and misfortunes sent upon men by God. And so, yes, a whip, a scourge, does represent the tongue. Yeshua had to be whipped because we couldn't shut our mouths. He took the sin of the world upon himself in more than one way. The suffering, death is one thing, but the suffering that he went through, the scourging, Adonai had to scourge him because of our slander, because of the things we say. I did that. Every one of us did that to him. Those of us who would never cross our minds to pick up a whip and to strike Yeshua HaMashiach, our Messiah, even once, we repeatedly scourge him with the words we speak against brothers and sisters in Messiah. That's hard, but it's true. And by his stripes, we should be healed of gossip and slander. When we're talking about somebody, I hope it's to build them up, to heal a situation, to cover, to atone for a multitude of sins. Yeah. Whiplashes. Whiplashes in Torah were prescribed as punishments when people violated typically the mishpatim, the judgments. We might say mostly for the violation of a negative commandment. And again, like we said, those whiplashes can be literal by human hands, or it can be through divine judgment. Deuteronomy 25:1, it says, if there's a dispute between men and they go to court and the judges decide their case and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall then make him lie down and be beaten in his presence with the number of stripes according to his guilt. He may beat him 40 times, but no more, so that he does not beat him with many more stripes than these. Your brother is not degraded in your eyes. Wouldn't it be nice if every dispute had a clear innocent person and a clear guilty person? But how often does that happen, that we completely know the righteous and the innocent from the wicked and the guilty? But even in this case where it's clear, it says the punishment shouldn't be degrading. Even though the wicked didn't extend that mercy to the righteous, you can't humiliate with the whiplashes. But slander, they say, incurs divine whiplashes. And remember, slander takes a truth and turns people's hearts against something. Remember the slander of the 10 evil spies concerning the land of Israel itself? They told the truth about what they saw in the land. It was the way they packaged and placed the words that turned the hearts of Israel against its own land. They use the truth to turn hearts against the land. And so the result was divine whiplashes. Numbers 13:4 says, according to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days, for every day you shall bear your guilt a year, even 40 years, and you will know my opposition. So Moses didn't give anyone a literal whooping over the slander and the peddling of the malicious talk. It was the same as in the Garden of Eden. The sentence was death, that kind of whiplash. He says, okay, these slanderers, they're going to die off in 40 years. How do we know it was for slander? Because nothing happened to Joshua and Caleb. The slanderers is, okay, a year for a day. That's a whiplash. And that's how the whiplashes were kind of portioned out. Based on the crime, they would determine the number of whiplashes. And they would stop at 39 just in case somebody made a mistake. But those are divine whiplashes. It's almost like Adonai is judging the degree of malice each man arrogantly kindled with his tongue. And so he says, okay, here's a 40-year death timetable. I'm going to execute some of you sooner, some of you later in the journey. Because you scourged, you whiplashed with your tongue, I'm going to whiplash you. I'm going to do like Adam and Eve. You could have ascended into the land, like going back into the garden, and you gave an evil report. And I'm not going to let you back in there doing the same thing that got you kicked out. Here's what Yeshua describes. Luke 12:42. The Lord said, who then is the faithful and sensible steward whom his master will put in charge of his servants to give them their rations at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that slave says in his heart, my master will be a long time in coming, and begins to beat the slaves, he's doing violence, Hamas, both men and women, and to eat and drink and get drunk. Remember the beating, the scourge of the tongue. These are kind of the same things that Paul taught against, like no drunkards, no revilers. He says the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. In other words, when you cut him in pieces, you separate spirit from soul from body. And then what happens, then the soul, if you're righteous, is assigned a place under the throne, under the altar, with the other righteous souls. Then there are souls that are completely wicked. And then there's some that just kind of hang out in the middle. Yeshua calls them lukewarm. It's not a great place to be. But just because an unbeliever is an unbeliever doesn't mean that he'll be judged completely wicked. Right? There's three kind of categories that we've talked about. He's saying this one, who was constantly doing Hamas, beating his fellow servants, slandering, he says, I'll go ahead and stick him over here with the unbelievers for a while. I'll cut, you know, that happens at death. You get cut into three pieces, actually more than that. But he says, that slave who knew his master's will and did not get ready or act in accord with his will receive many lashes. But the one who did not know it and committed deeds worthy of a flogging will receive but few. For everyone who has been given much, much will be required. And to whom they entrusted much, of him they will ask all the more. This is why it's so important. If you know about the Passover, if you know the spiritual significance of the Passover, you've been given much. And therefore, much will be required of you going into that feast. So when is it okay to be a tattletale? Well, we can look at our text at the scroll of Esther. Mordecai and Esther will show us exactly how to do it. When truth will save a life, did he overhear a plot to assassinate the king? Yes. Did he sit by and say, well, I don't want to be a tattletale? No. When it will save a life, then yes, please go tell someone. Yes, it is still like, if you see something, say something, please. If it's serious, because he told the plot, the king was not assassinated. He saved his life. And that plays into the story later on. Later, Queen Esther does it in a much bolder way. She sets the king up, but then with the wicked one right in her presence, what does she do? Instead of allowing the wicked one to accuse her, she accuses the wicked one in the very presence of the king, and she saves the lives of all the Jews in Persia. Sometimes you just have to call out the plots of the wicked in the presence of the king. That's not tattletaling. That's saving lives. So the assassins, the potential assassins of the king and the wicked Haman, may his name be blotted out, they both set out to do the same thing with their tongues. They set out to kill. And given time, they would have completed that killing task that their tongues began. And it started with very arrogantly deciding who had a right to live and who had a right to die. That's exactly what we're doing when we slander someone. We're being arrogant and we're deciding whose reputation has a right to live and whose reputation should die. Because biblically, your name is your reputation. We even say it, my good name, or he doesn't have a great reputation. His name is not that great. What does that mean? It's who you are. And so when we start flogging our enemies with gossip and slander, we're killing their reputations. We have to make proper judgments. And it's not an easy job sometimes to know when to tell someone about something and when to keep it to yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. That's the proper context of that commandment. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you were doing the same thing, would it be important for that to be told in order for repentance to take place or just to stop something from happening that you didn't realize it? We can save a life by telling sometimes. We can save a reputation. So if you'll remember in the Torah portion by Vayigash, Judah goes before Joseph, not knowing who Joseph is. Remember, Benjamin will not bow. That's another reason. I don't think Mordecai can bow before wicked Haman. May his name be blotted out. He's an Amalekite. The Amalekites, remember, are descended from Esau. Benjamin was the only son who didn't bow before Esau when Jacob returned to the land. Benjamin didn't bow then. Mordecai says, Benjamin not going to bow now. No. But you know what? Atoning for other people, covering for other people. Sometimes we don't even know if they're innocent. Judah didn't know if Benjamin was innocent. In fact, for all practical purposes, it looked like he was guilty. Had there been a proper investigation in the end, I'm sure it would have been found out who put the cup in the bag. But before we have a proper investigation, sometimes we need to assume the best and try to atone and try to keep the family together. And then later, it's turned the other way. And in the scroll of Esther, it's Benjamin who atones for Judah. Mordechai and Esther, it says they're Benjaminites. And what do? They atone for the Jews and Persia. Atonement can be a painful thing. Peacemaking is a painful thing because it's going to carry the risk of a personal loss. Judah says, take me instead. Just take me. Don't take the boy. Queen Esther said, if I'm destroyed, I'm destroyed. If I perish, I perish. Okay. If it will save my people. And so we have to have that same kind of courage. We're not different. We have to have the same kind of courage to atone for one another and try to find a way to package and place those words that will bring people together, that will devise, instead of a wicked plan to separate them further out, instead devise a plan to bring them closer in. Like, admittedly, maybe they did something dumb. But you know what? Sometimes we can say it in such a way that's just the opposite of like taking some of the truth and then making it even worse. Sometimes we can take a little bit of the truth and make it even better. We can help other people stand in their shoes and see what they're going through. We can figure out a way together to improve the situation. If we're going to conspire, let's conspire for this person's good, to restore them, to make people think more highly of them. So when we see that cart full of words rolling our way and we see the peddler pushing the cart, we know what to do. Sometimes it's unwitting. We didn't realize we received slander. The king, I mean, we don't want to slander the king, but his reactions, he's a bit of a doofus. He's listening to the wrong people. But in the story, we can see where a man who banished his own queen because she disrespected him, and he thinks it's going to affect every woman in the kingdom. Oh my goodness. In the end, do you see how the work of Esther built up the king to the point he says, whatever you want, my dear, up to half the kingdom. Wow. What would you like, my dear? What can I do for you today? She built him up instead of saying, you fool, you're about to kill me and all my people. No, she didn't blame the fool. She blamed the wicked one, the peddler in his presence. She let the king see for himself that in that case, he'd been a bit of a doofus. She didn't have to accuse him of being a doofus. If we know how to package it, I mean, she was wise, so full of wisdom. And she just created the situation where he could see what he did and he didn't have to lose his dignity. Didn't mean he didn't get some divine whiplashes. He did. He had received the words even unwittingly. And what happens? He's going to lose hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in his kingdom. Death did result from receiving those words. But it was much less harm than could have been. But when we see, it's exactly what the sages say. When we receive those words, death is going to happen. He could send out another decree to try to mitigate it. It could have been much worse. Adonai still would have protected his people. He didn't need the king. But he allowed the king to go through that process to see the importance of words and who you're receiving them from. Know who's talking to you. Know what their agenda is. He finally figured it out on a sleepless night that Haman was after his kingdom. He was after his wife. He figured it out. And it was all Adonai working behind the scenes. And he didn't really see that coming. But if that's true of somebody who didn't see it coming, imagine how much more, like Yeshua said, those will suffer who did know better than to receive the words. And they just forked over the cries to the juicy fruit from slanderous lips. Like Yeshua said, it's just Hamas. It's beating up your fellow servants. It's doing violence. It's killing them. And we think it doesn't cost us anything. It's just free fruit juice, but there's a cost. There's divine whiplashes. There's a judgment. If we fail to judge ourselves, we will be judged in the heavenlies. If we'll judge ourselves now, then we don't have to worry about future judgment. If we just throw our hands up and say, well, the tongue, nobody can tame it. Why should I even try? You should try. You should try. I should try. Because there's whiplash coming. When that cart just skids to a stop before the throne and the judge of all the earth, there's going to be lots of people getting some whiplash. We don't want to be one of them. We want to deal with it long before we arrive at Passover. We don't want that kind of chametz in our house. So we can practice each year. Hopefully we're getting a little bit better. When we're hit with these situations where we know we have to talk about certain things, we can learn better ways of dealing with it. Like I said, we can say, yes, we have a problem here. Clearly there's a problem. But rather than just repeating it to the next person, could you and I work on this to build this person up? You know, could we be their secret helper? Can we create situations? Can we package and place words in such a way that the person will come to repentance without further damaging what they've already done to themselves? In the same way that we would conspire to kill someone's reputation, we can also conspire to preserve it. It's clear, you know, certain things people have to be put out for a while so that they'll come to themselves, that they'll understand, yes, there is consequences and judgment if we go on sinning. But I would say out of that list of things that Paul rattled off, the one that we're least likely to deal with is slander, because we're judging ourselves when we do it. We're cutting ourselves some slack when we do it, when we overlook a slander, because like James says, we all do it. And that's why we're so hesitant. Wouldn't I be a hypocrite to call that out? Or if this person has come over here and gossiped, you know, every Wednesday night for the last 10 years, and all of a sudden I just stop and say, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear everything that happened over the last week. Let's do Bible study. Let's talk about something else. Okay. Won't they call me a hypocrite? You bet they will. Just wait for it. Wait for it. Yeah. They're going to call you a hypocrite if all of a sudden you dig in and say, I'm not filling up that cart anymore, and I don't want you dumping in my lap every bit of manure you've heard this week. I don't want to be a word pervert. We can do better. We can always do better. And that's what to me, it's my goal that we are part of the adversary getting kicked out of heaven. We're responsible for him being there, number one. But if I'm responsible for him being there, accusing before the throne, can I not also be responsible for helping take him down little by little? If I'll change my behavior, what I'm willing to listen to, what I'm willing to see, and definitely what I'm willing to repeat. You might lose some friends over it. But if they're only friends with you, if you allow them to dump manure in your lap, maybe they're not the best friends to have.
Thank you for exploring the Torah portion with us. For more information on this ministry, go to thecreationgospel.com. You can find links there for our newsletter, books, workbooks, Facebook, and our YouTube channel.